Tzayef. Welcome back to In Person. We are in the middle of Perek Vav, so we'll finish that up and get into Zion tonight. I have my Tanakh instead of my Megillah. Sorry, all of a sudden today, of course, of all the get horse day when we're doing In Person cheer, but that's okay. Okay,
we're... Water?
No, it doesn't seem to help. It's okay. Okay, we are up to Perek Vav, Pasuk Yud Bet. So, we had Haman taking Mordechai on a horse. We talked about how he marched him through the streets, and we're going to do a lot of Gemaras tonight about the coming to Pesukim. So what happens? He says to everybody, Kach yasel ish asher machavit bikaro, and Pasuk Yudbet, Vayashav Mordechai el shar ha-melech, v'Haman nidchas al beito avel v'chafoy rosh. What does avel v'chafoy rosh mean? Avel, good morning. Chafoy Rosh.
Sounds like humiliated.
Okay. So pshat, expression-wise, context-wise, he was humiliated. He was low. He was in a bad state. Any other ideas?
He was really unhappy.
Okay. It's an emotional reflection of emotion.
I learned that it had to do with his daughter pouring buckets.
Yeah, so this is like one of those, for the children who are brought up on Midrashim, one of those like classic childhood Midrashim. His daughter was on the Mepeset, right? She thought it was her father who was riding the horse in Mordechai, and she dumped the bucket in the set. So we're going to do this inside. But this is the root of it, because one of the things that I like to do is, when there's a midrash that everyone's like, he heard of this midrash from somewhere, where did this midrash come from? It came from the words, avel. Why is he avel? Maybe it's an expression that's kind of a funny word. It's a very specific word. Mourning isn't usually used to just mean that someone's humiliated. So here he actually was mourning, and chafoy rosh, his head was actually covered with something, not only humiliated. So this is the pshat origin of that midrash, and we're going to start on... In the Gemara, Daf Tzayin Amud Aleph, which is in English, the Kabbalah view, it's a 16:82, the first one that I sent. Vayikra lefanav kach yaseh. It quotes the first pasuk, La'ish Hashem el chafitz bikaro, ki Haman akid v'azo v'shvila d'vei Haman. So here he's leading Mordechai through the streets, Dafka, the street of Haman. He went through the whole town. So that means Haman and Mordechai are actually marching through Haman's own street. It's a residential neighborhood. Chazite barate zekaime aigra. And his daughter was standing on the roof, and she saw this. Sabrahai zerachiv afuqa. She thought the one who was riding was her father. Vahai demaske kame Mordechai. And the one who was walking was Mordechai. Shakala atzitza zeveit hakise. She took the chamber pot. You know, the nice versions of the children's in the dressing room, like the garbage can, but it was the chamber pot. Ushdite areshe davua, and she threw it on the reshe, the head of her father. Dale ene, he looked up, he raised his eyes, chazad davuahu. And when Haman looked up to see what in the world is going on, to her horror, his daughter noticed that it was her father. Nafla meigra le'ara umeta. She fell, or perhaps purposely fell, from the roof, and she fell to the ground and died. And this is what's written when it says Mordechai went back to the king's gate. Amarav Sheshet. Next page. Sheshav l'sako l'tanito. What was Mordechai doing? He was, what did he do in the Shar HaMelech? He was always in the Shar HaMelech. But these couple of days, he was specifically fasting in his sackcloth at the Shar HaMelech. The Haman, and in the meantime, Haman, what was he doing? He was nidchaf al beito avel v'shchafoy rosh. He went home. Actually, avel al bito v'chafoy rosh al she'eralo, because of what happened to him. Very colorful midrash. But if again, like every time I said last week, different people have been, we had like a certain consistency. I don't know who heard which year. And so if you heard, if you didn't, I'll tell you now. We were talking about the Maharal at one point, that he said that Esav, who was Amalek's ancestor, and of course Esav and Amalek, and then all the way down the line of Haman, that they had a certain nitiya towards Shmutz, that Esav came out all hairy and bloody and gross when he was born, and these things indicate a certain chitzonius, hair and blood and dirty things, whereas he cleaned away, he came out first, so the Midrash had said that he came out first so that he could clear out all the Shmutz from the womb so that Yaakov could come out chalak. he could come out clean and smooth, and this is a dichotomy between Esav, who's attracted to the shmutz of the world, and Chitzonius, and Yaakov, of course, who is the opposite. And so we had connected this to a different famous midrash in the Gemara about how Haman was a barber, and he also was a bathhouse attendant. And so he had the same kind of netiyah towards schmutz and chitzonius, he was cleaning it up, but Maharal connects it anyway, that this was the type of material that he worked with, was cleaning people from their schmutz and hair, and that was because the connection way back from Esav, a certain nature he had. And this, he connects as well, Maharal there, that this is, it's not a coincidence that she was cleaning out a chamber pot. He was attracted to schmutz, and schmutz was attracted to him. This is the persona of Esav, Amalek, and Haman. And the other thing Maral has said there is that the downfall of Haman had to be complete. It was like a total turnabout. And so his downfall couldn't just happen all in one shot, the Babachat, because it was too extreme. It had to be kind of in stages of degradation. And so we had said in that same Gemara that first he was degraded because he was the bathhouse attendant, because he was the barber for Mordechai, because he walked into the streets. And now it's a step worse with his chamber pot on his head and actual mourning for his daughter. This is the context that this midrash is coming in.
And along with that idea, of course, the word that's used is the same word that's used later.
Yes.
He is.
Chafoy Rus.
It's Chafoy Panim, but it's Chafoy.
Interesting. Nora also points out Panim is the Tzel Melekim of a person. And so, again, it's this gradual degradation where it's his Rosh, and then the Panim is his entire Tzel Melekim of a human being was essentially graded, erased, covered up, lowered. Okay, good point. Okay, so then he comes home in this terrible state. And what happens? He goes to his wife. Pasuk Yagimel Vaisafer Haman Lazarashishto Ulacho Avav Et Kolashir Karahu Vaimrulo Chachamav Vizarashishto Im Mizarayu Dimorchai Asherachi Lotu Limpolafanav Lotu Chalo Kinafol Tipol Lefanav. So Haman goes to his wife Zeresh and to all of his loved ones, those same people he was bragging to earlier about how he was up on top. Now he's coming to in a state of being on the bottom. He said everything that happened, and his Chachamav and Zeresh Ishto told him, if Mordechai is from a lineage of Jews, then you're starting to fall in front of him, you're starting to be in this low state, so you're not going to get up from it. You're going to keep falling. If this is the people you're up against, then they're winning. So the Gemara has something to say about this too. This is a continuation of what we were up to from before, to Zion Aleph. This time the second page of level 3. By Sefer Haman Lazarashishto Lokol Ahavav. Kare Luhu Ohavav. I'll pause for a second. What's weird about this pasuk?
Wasn't it Hamah?
Okay, so the pasuk said two different descriptions. First it says he went to Zeresh and his Ohavav, and then who answered him? The Chachamav and Zeresh. What happened to Ohavav? Who are the Chachamav? Who are these people?
Well, so, Zeresh is not either of them.
Isn't that interesting? The Gemara doesn't comment on that, but that's an interesting observation. Uh-huh. Okay, or she just maybe category into herself, because she has a special, you know, shot is like she has a special role. But, interesting. Okay, so what's with the two terminologies? Karei Luhu Ohavav, Vikarei Luhu Chachamav. They're called, is the same people who are called by two different terms? Like, what's going on? Why? Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Yochanan says, Kol ha'omer dvar chachma afilu b'umot ha'olam nikra chacham. Whoever has a piece of advice, who has wisdom to share, even if they're umot ha'olam, is called a chacham. So, implication being, the ohavav are the chachamav. It's just saying, he went to them and he told them everything that happened, and they came back and gave him advice. Even from our perspective, it's good advice. If the Jews are winning, the Jews are going to win. You're not going to win against them. Right? So, they said, nice piece of chachma, the Jews are going to win. Good. His loved ones are also smart. They're also the wise ones. And they're called both because he didn't just, it didn't just happen to be that he consulted with his family, but they also said the truth. They also were wise in what they said. And says Gemara, presumably, one might think that umos ha'olam, these are Haman's people, they're not the Jewish Chachamim. We had the Jewish Chachamim in conversation, being consulted with Achashverosh and Haman earlier in Megillah. This is not those people. This is the non-Jewish people, but still, if they say wisdom, they're called Chachamim. And what I just think is interesting is that sometimes, I think it's interesting that it first calls it Ohavav. Why didn't it just say Chachamim? And it's his family. You know, we know from earlier that he consulted with his people at home. But in the same pasuk, we have Ohavav and Chachamav. To me, that highlights that sometimes we don't realize that our Ohavav can be our Chachamav. Right? We just like vent to our family. What do you want to say?
Sorry, no, I understand. Yeah. I thought it would be, this is the first thing they've ever said that was smart. That's when they could be called Chachamav.
Could be. Yeah, could be.
I always felt like it was really cruel. And they were kind of like the rats running from the ship. Oh, all of a sudden, you have this to say? Like, oh, now that things aren't going well.
Chacham doesn't have
to
be nice.
Now you're so Chacham, right? They couldn't have told me this, like,
maybe they switched. First they were Ohavav, and then they weren't acting like such Ohavav anymore. They're only acting like the Chachamav. You know, you could be nice and you could be smart. You could be loving to someone and you could be say the, what's truth and what's correct.
Well, he's utterly humiliated and covered with schmutz, and they're just trashing him, you know. They're not.
Right? So take home lesson. Number one, value what your family has to say. You might, you know, sometimes like a spouse, or sometimes people say this, like the spouse mentioned, and the person goes and asks, like the other spouse goes and asks their mentor or whoever, and they're like, oh, it's a great idea. And they're like, I just told you that. You know, or sometimes even kids could say smart things sometimes. Right? But like, whatever, this kid, like, that's not where we get our source of wisdom from. Anyone could have it. You say, well, it's wise, you're a wise person. And we have to keep our ears open for that, to notice. But even people who are not related to it in that way usually say wise things to listen to it. And again, from the flip side, we have to be careful. And we're the ones giving the advice that are both Ohavav and Chachamav, that we say what's true, we also do it in a sensitive way, that's a loving way. So continues the Gemara. What is the advice? In Yizerah HaYehudim Mordechai, right, if Mordechai is from the Jews, then, and you're starting to fall, so not a full people, you're going to fall even more. Amrulay, so what did they say to Haman? Im Ishar Shvatim Kasi. If Mordechai, presumably talking about Mordechai here, is from the other Shvatim, Yachlatle, then maybe you could win against him. Then you have a chance. V'imisheva Yehuda u'binyamin v'Ephraim u'minashe. But if he's from the Shvatim of Yehuda, binyamin, Ephraim, u'minashe, lo yachlatle, then you have no chance. And the Gemara gives a proof, Yehuda. You can't beat it. Yehuda, why? Detziv yadchav orech oybecha. Because his bracha from Yaakov was that your hand will be your enemy's knee. He's going to win over his enemy's Yehuda. Enoch, the other Shvatim over here, Dechtivu l'fnei Ephraim u'binyamin u'minashe ora et gvuratecha. That there's also a pasuk in Tehillim that these other Shvatim are going to also win against their enemies. So, first of all, we know, we said originally, Mordechai was both from Yehuda on one side of the family and also from Binyamin on the other side of the family. And so, you know, point being, you're stuck on one, you're not gonna, to win here. But then the Gemara says one more thing about this comment. Ki nafolti pol lefanav. Why does it have this double language here? Darshav Yehuda bar Ilai, what does it say? Shtei nifilut halalu lama. Why does it have an expression of two different forms? Nafolti pol. Amrlo. Because why? Because they said to Haman, uma zu mishula la'afar, umishula la'kochavim. They're compared to dirt, to the afar, and they're also compared to the stars. Kishahin yordin, yordin ad afar. When they fall way down to the dirt, to the ground. Ukhashin olin, olin ad lakochavim. But when they rise up to the stars. So my question is, first of all, why is the Gemara singling out these shvatim? What's the difference? If he started to fall, because, look, first of all, by the way, all these people of Haman's, they're starting to notice the same hashgacha pratis that the Jewish characters in the story were already noticing a while back, right? The fact that Haman wanted to hang Mordechai and destroy all the Jews, and all of a sudden, lo and behold, he's, you know, leading the horse for Mordechai, even his close people started noticing that. It's a little strange. And they're like, I don't know if you're winning anymore, Haman. So why should it matter what Shevet Mordechai is from? If he's losing, he's losing. Look, Haman, you're degraded now. So you're going to keep being degraded. Things are not looking good for you. Who cares what Shevet they're from? Question number one. Question number two, how does the Gemara answer the question of the double Lashon? Nafolti pol. Okay? Because the Bnei Yisrael describes in two ways, as the dirt and as the stars. So you would think Nafolti pol is like two expressions of falling. But both the dirt and the stars are expressions of rising. Or the dirt is in the ground and the sky. Like, what is the Gemara telling us? These are my two questions. Anyone have an idea? You can read the Gemara and she's like, okay, very nice. Or you can like stop and think and say, what is really, what's the point? What's the message here? Okay, let's start. Let's start with the second one because it's shorter. Okay, that otherwise we're going to forget about the second question. Okay, the question of the stars and the sky. Okay, on a simple level, really, truly, B'nai Yisrael is compared to the dust of the earth and the stars. Why? In its original context. Is it a positive thing or a negative thing?
The positive thing because of the number, the multitude.
Right. Even though the dirt happens to be down, so you might associate in your head falling and down. But really, they're both praise for B'nai Yisrael. We're compared to two great things. It's to be many, many people. Right? This is the bracha of Avraham Avinu, of Am Yisrael. And so, if we have a double bracha of rising up to be great and large, so someone who's already falling in front of us has a double falling. To me, that's the simple implication of the Gemara. But something doesn't sit right with me even about that. What's with the dirt and what's with the sky? And I'm going to remind myself who says this. So I can quote it right. The Ben Yehoyada says that dirt sounds like falling in the dirt. There's a reason why the Gemara mentions the afar, which sounds like the falling, even though it's a praise. Because what's the nature of Am Yisrael? Yes, if we're rising up, we can rise as high as the stars. We're lamala min hateva, lamala from mazel. We can be numerous, you know, like in the original bracha. The stars are clearly when B'nai Yisrael is on top, literally and figuratively. When we're in a good place and we're winning, so we're like the stars. But what's the message of the being compared to the dirt? The nature of Am Yisrael is when we fall in the dirt, we're not just falling. Because dirt is dirt. And when you're in, what happens when something gets wedged in the dirt, a seed gets wedged in the dirt, it grows. And even in the dirt, we blossom. Now, the bracha of the afar is even when it looks like we're on the bottom, we're really not on the bottom. There's a growth process going on. There's a development, there's a progression. Am Yisrael, really, from our downs, we come up. We do tshuva, even if we have our own downs and we're sinning, we do tshuva from that, we grow from that. And so, if already, before we really looked like we were low, right? We said also early in the Megillah that, in general, B'nai Yisrael were indulged, that they were looked upon in a negative way. Achshverosh, in general, viewed us negatively before we were down. But Kal v'chomer, if we were down and now Mordechai is starting to be up on top and Haman is starting to go low, then for sure we have a double falling of Haman, because B'nai Yisrael is on top because literally, you know, apparently in front of their eyes we're starting to be on top of Mordechai, and we're doubly on top because even if we have a problem and we're not really saved from the Gedera and we haven't totally been saved, right, it's not completely on top, but even in our downs we're still up. And so therefore, by default, Haman is doubly down. This is our encouragement to push us forward, to, you know, keep us going in the down, in the low times, whether it be by our own fault or by some other reason. Either way, there's always potential to grow. There's always potential to improve and for things to get better. This is the message of the offer. Okay, so now we'll go back to the Shvatim. What is going on with the Shvatim? First of all, does anyone remember anything from other drash that we talked about? Word association, allusions of Yehuda, we said, that I mentioned, you know, the lineage of Mordechai, but in addition to that, Yehuda, Binyamin, Ephraim, Manasseh. It's okay.
You mentioned Yehuda's twin.
Okay. I don't remember when we mentioned that.
They were linked to the name.
Right. Okay. That was Dafka. Right, it was mentioned in Midrash, kind of among other things in Midrash, okay. Okay, so Ephraim and Asher are both Yosef, is related to Yosef. But it's not, he's not only mentioned, also he is mentioned, of course. So I am going to focus more on Binyamin, Ephraim and Asher. Yehuda, we know that Mordechai is also from Yehuda, and we have a pasuk quote here from Shev Yehuda. But the other Shvatim here are not just a coincidence. Well, obviously Binyamin, if you think about it, who's from Binyamin? That's part of this whole intergenerational tikkun process of the fight against Amalek with Shaul HaMelech, right? So the most clear connection is that originally Shaul HaMelech from Sheva Binyamin had messed up. He was supposed to destroy all of Amalek. And he was imperfect in that mission, and that allowed for descendants of Amalek to be born, and ultimately Haman to be born, and so it's only appropriate that a descendant of Shaul and Shev Binyamin should be the one to do that tikkun, to fix up the mistake. And so, if already the person from Shev Binyamin is this Mordechai who is rising up, then it doesn't look good for Haman, right? Because that means the tikkun process is in the works, and things are happening, and the wheels are turning, and ultimately the tikkun is in the process of happening already, which means Haman is going to end up on the bottom, because it's a tikkun for Amalek not being on the bottom, you know, for Amalek surviving. So this is Binyamin in particular, but it's broader than that. What role do Ephraim, Menashe, and Yosef, as the father of both of them, have in all this? So for this, first, one point we have mentioned in the past is that the Maharal mentioned along the way at one point that the children of Rachel Imenu are going to be the ones destined to win against Esav. And we had made a reference to this, that Binyamin didn't bow down, Mordechai wouldn't bow down to Haman, and that his ancestor Binyamin didn't bow down to Esav when Yaakov had bowed down to Esav. He was only one, and there's also some degree of connection there of the descendants making some sort of tikkun, and I'm going to keep that in the back of our minds. But it's even broader than that. There's a book, thank you to Rav Judah Michel for introducing me to this book, by a man named Rabbi Yoel Kahn. The whole entire book is building parallels and connections between the, you're familiar with it?
I don't think I've heard of the book, but I've heard
the phenomenon. You're going to fill in some blanks for us. Let me brainstorm to figure this out. Okay, there's a lot of parallels between the Yosef story and the Esther story. And Yosef as an individual, and Mordechai especially as an individual. And first, we can just throw out, this is what I really want to discuss in person, because it's more fun when we like throw around ideas. Like, word association, you know, Yosef story, Esther story. What comes to mind? What's similar?
Well, they're both living in Chutzpah Aretz, and they're keeping their Lashon, and they're keeping their Segedim, and they're staying faithful in a very strange,
noticeable, strong, brave, courageous, yeah.
In a palace.
Okay, there's royalty, yep.
Mm-hmm. And to hide their identity.
Interesting. In different ways. Yeah. Until it was revealed. There's a certain high, like, climax of a moment when Yosef's identity is revealed and Esther's identity is revealed. It wasn't the right thing, though, for much of the time. Interesting.
They each have a relationship with the king. That they are a courtier to the king, used by the king, serving the king and serving.
And yet rose into their own shoes as a very important role in that context, not only subservient, but also holding their own. It was a positive relationship with the king and royalty. They were important.
A lot of the time.
They were brought to the palace against their will.
Yes. Yosef didn't start out that way, right? He rose up in the middle. He wasn't even asked to be elected. Obviously, Esther didn't either.
I guess they each identify an enemy of the king, they each identify an enemy of the king.
Where in the
Yosef? Well, Yosef interprets the dream and says, this guy, he interprets the dream and no, that's wrong.
Take it back. Okay, maybe not enemy. There's a midrash in Me'am Lois that says that Mordechai actually looked towards, it's a little bit similar to what you're saying, but he looked towards Yosef as a role model when the Big Son and Terah story happened, because he was wondering, like, what's the right thing to do here? On one hand, you know, save someone's life, save the king's life. On the other hand, he's like a Russia of a king, you know, who hates Klai Israel, so like, really, what am I supposed to do here? And he looked toward, you know, and he said, okay, I have a connection to the kingdom here, and do I try to work in the benefit of the kingdom, of this foreign kingdom, or do I work against the foreign kingdom? And he Dafka looked towards Yosef as a role model, who Dafka interpreted the dreams in order to save Mitzrayim and support this foreign kingdom, and he said, okay, I'm supposed to support the foreign kingdom, I'm supposed to save his life, and that directed him in what to do. So there's some connection there, in terms of their efforts for the king. The kingdom. There's a lot of ideas. There's a whole book of it.
I was thinking more about how Yosef identified. He doesn't tell it to the king, but he tells it to the people involved, you're going to die, you're not going to die. He identifies the person who obviously...
He's relating to a death of the people.
You know.
Okay.
Not a great connection, but...
Each piece has a big reveal of the Suda.
Yeah.
There's the Suda, yeah. Food has a good role there.
And then also after this, like, epoch, they still were in the palace, not necessarily wanting to be there, but, like, till the end of their lives.
Interesting. They stayed royal. They stayed in the palace.
They call him Ishmael and Mela, also, Martha?
Yeah. I believe so, later on. Yep, towards the end of Megillah. Good one.
They were both exiled from Eretz Israel.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So here, there's like random different Torahs that like pull on one element from one story and relate it to an element of another story. Big, I remember this was like really big when I was a kid in the Pesach Seder, that like what the symbolism of the Karpas is Milashon Pasim, Ketonet Pasim, because the whole Sheep of Mitzrayim all started from the Ketonet Pasim. That this is where the whole...
The only place in the Torah where it says Karpas is
here. Kor Karpas. Okay, so even, so this connection goes back even before the Yeshua, and before this part of the story goes back, and also before Yosef was in the palace. Okay, it started, clothing is a big element in both of them, from the Ketonet Pasim to Yosef giving 5 sets of clothing to Binyamin, to his own royal clothing, and then in the Megillah it's mentioned a lot of clothing also, whether it's the cloth of the party, or Mordechai's royal clothing, or the sackcloth, or whatever. There's a lot of elements that keep coming up. So we could just end there. Cool. Why? What are we getting from this? Obviously one story is supposed to make us think of the other. Obviously, apparently.
Well, we already saw like the role model in this.
Okay, so one thing is just pretty straightforward, which is we need to learn from our ancestors, from our role models, and look for precedents. Yeah. Yeah. There's another midrash that Esther, doesn't even sound as related, that Esther looked to Yosef also as a role model for endearing herself to the kingdom, where Yosef had a certain chen to him, and combined with his inner strength against adversarial conditions, and that Esther pulled on these traits from her ancestor, her role model, not exactly ancestor, because Yosef is not Benjamin, which we have to, but from Yosef in this connected story, and gained strength from him. So this is a major thing that Mordechai and Esther apparently knew how to do. They knew how to look back towards Torah stories, even though they're in our Torah story, but they had their own Torah stories already, and they knew how to look towards those in order to guide themselves in their lives for inspiration and for guidance, and this is something that we need to do ourselves. Okay. Yeah, I was going to say, it's even more complicated because the Yosef story even has connections early, like the Ketonet Pasim idea. We had... there is a connection we had made about how after the Gezer was sent out, Haman and Ahasuerus sat down to eat and drink, right? And there was a connection, we said, to the brothers right after they sold Yosef. They sat down to eat and feast. And there's a certain, in the negative, there's also connections. There's a pagam in both that is also connected. Latov and Lora. Let's see if we can formulate something.
When you do something and you go eat, it feels like you're in a good mood, like you don't feel like heavy, like, well,
you can't eat when you're upset.
Right, like the fact that you go and have like a party or have a feast after it just sounds like you're happy, like you think like you, know,
right, so we had said,
so
when there's a sin, when there's a negative thing, and that was the problem with Mordechai and Achashverosh in our context, and that was the problem with the brothers in their context. So what's going on here? Not only are they pulling on the good things to bring Yeshua, but apparently the bad thing is, you look like you're like thinking, you're like wheel turning.
Remember you said that when Mordechai and Haman sat down, they were very uncomfortable that there was this undercurrent that
they were trying to distract themselves.
Right.
And that's why they drank. They drank wine in order to forget the guilt.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So when I was reading this, honestly, it could be it says it somewhere in this book, and I didn't find it because I'll be honest, I didn't read the book from cover to cover. But when I'm seeing all these connections, and it can't be a coincidence, there must be some message or there must be some explanation or reason or something, and it could just be learned from your ancestors and from your role models. Done. And I started searching for things because I thought there must be something deeper under the surface. And what I found is that apparently the Ari said there's a Gilgal thing going on here. There, and whenever there's a Gilgal, what's the concept of Gilgal? The concept of Gilgal is... it's a tikkun. That someone in some lifetime messed up, and even at the end of their life, it wasn't totally quite fixed up. There was some tikkun that still had to happen. So the neshama comes back in a different life, in a different person, a different time and place, as someone who can rectify this element in a way, in some way, in their life.
So
right? You're in suspense. What's your guess? This is my... Okay.
I would say Esther, but...
Okay. It was who? Who's that? Is he Yosef? Okay. Makes sense. Any other guesses?
Yeah,
okay. Which I also like the like disguised costume-esque overtones of the Gilgal thing in the Purim story. Kind of interesting. Any other guesses? Esther and Yosef? Okay. So the Ari says that Mordechai is a Gilgal of?
Mm-hmm. One of the brothers that sold.
Great guesses. Go back. Go way back. The problem didn't start with the brothers. The problem started with Yaakov.
Showing favorites.
Bum, bum, bum. Okay? Wow. The problem started with Yaakov. Does anyone remember, where did we see this before? There was an element of Onesh, that Mordechai was in a certain position of Onesh because of a flaw in Yaakov, a mistake that he made. We read into it a little bit. It was a drash Megemara. I like this little chazara as we're finished. Miguel, it's good to like do a little chazara over here, right? Mordechai, what did he say? He cried out, Zakat Gedula Mara. Who else, if you don't remember, then now think from your mind, who else cried out, Zakat Gedula Mara? Was Esav. Okay, and we said, wait a minute, Esav cried out, Zakat Gedula Mara, because Yaakov was supposed to trick him. He was listening to Rivka and she had Nebuah, and I thought he did the right thing. So why are we seeing something bad? Because Esav cried out because Yaakov did the right thing. So Mordechai has to cry out Zakat Gedula Mara because Bnei Israel has a favor of genocide? Like, what? We said that maybe, and we even made a connection at the end of class, an interesting deal someone made, and maybe even there was an element of Mordechai's personality that still was a little incomplete in this area, that even if he was doing the right thing, what is the Lashon Zakat Gedula Mara? It's a very genuine, deep pain. It's a real, real pain, even if it's coming from a Russia. And he said, maybe, even if Yaakov was supposed to trick him, was trick Yitzhak, he could have been a little bit more sensitive to Esav. Now, he didn't have to end up crying this painful, painful cry. And Mordechai was destined to cry out a painful cry. And maybe even Mordechai could have improved a little bit. He wasn't so sensitive to Haman. He had this midrash about him being the slave owner, and he kept like shoving it on his face, and like maybe he was justified, but maybe he didn't have to push in his face so much. So the problem goes back to Yaakov. This is one problem we already named in the Agadata. But more than that, also with Esav, he did another mistake, which was not against Esav, but actually in favor of Esav, which was bowing down to Esav. That, according to these Kabbalistic sources, that the flaw in Yaakov was, it wasn't really so appropriate for him to make himself so subservient to Esav. He bowed down 7 times. He sent him presents. He did all his preparations before the famous meeting, the famous confrontation between Yaakov and Esav. And okay, he had to do this. He had to daven. He had to send him presents. He had to appease him. He had to split his camp. He had to do all the things he did. But when he got there, he's bowing. And he's bowing again. And he's bowing. And it's like, enough already. Like, who's the tzaddik and who's the rasha here? And there was something that was a flaw in those bowings. And Binyamin and the whole family bowed down. It wasn't just Yaakov. It started with Yaakov. But the whole family bowed down, and the only one who didn't bow was Binyamin. So we have Binyamin is in a very unique position here. And of course, obviously, you know, Binyamin is Shaul's ancestor, and he didn't complete, and, you know, Esav is Amalek's ancestor, and Amalek's descendant, of course, is Haman. So we have to have the Tikkun come through this line. But where does Yosef come in? Where does Yosef come into all this? Who cares about Ephraim and Asher? Just say Binyamin. You want to throw in Yehuda because he's the leader of the family, okay? You know, but what's Yosef here? So in this book, Rabbi Yael Kahn points to something really interesting. He says, Yosef, in this big picture, he was in a really important position in the family. Right? Obviously from the beginning, why was Yaakov favoring him? Not some. Right? He felt that Yosef was supposed to carry on the legacy of the family. And he treated him as his special Talmud and his special son with a favoritism for a reason. He felt there was something special about Yosef. And even at the end of his life, in Vayechi, when he's giving brachas, right, he meets with Yosef separately, and he says to Yosef, V'atal shnei bonecha noladim lecha b'eretz Mitzrayim, ad bo'ei lecha Mitzrayimah, lihim, Ephraim v'Menashe, kir uvin v'shimon yuli. Yosef, we have Yosef, and Yosef has Ephraim Menashe, and Ephraim Menashe are just like Reuven and Shimon. What does that mean? We count them as Shvatim, right? But there are two of them. Each one of them was like Reuven and Shimon. Ki'ilu, Yosef had two Shvatim come out of him, which, according to Rabbi Yochanan's interpretation, he said he got a double portion. Essentially, Yosef was treated like the Bechor. The Bechor gets a double portion. What's Yosef doing with it? Yaakov viewed him as the leader, as the Bechor, as the one who was going to continue on the lineage. This is how he understood him to be. This is why he favored him. And even though there was a problem with that, granted, but there was an element of truth to it. And later on, he's in a position of leadership. The brothers bow down to him. It's this whole long thread of story. And so the tikkun of this problem here, this relationship between Yaakov and Esav, on one hand, the young one was in a perfect position to be mitakenit because he didn't have the flaw of doubt down to him. On the other hand, Yosef was supposed to carry on the lineage and all the missions of Yaakov. He was Kiyulak the Bechor, and he was a leader in the family later in the story. And so he was charged also with being mitakenit, the Yaakov's flaw. And the way Rabbi Kahn puts it is even when he was born, Yosef's name, why is he called Yosef? Hashem is going to add on another child to me. He said maybe Binyamin was supposed to help Yosef complete his mission. Yosef was like the Bechor, also Rachel was the original wife, but you know, it goes a little further back even than that. So the two of them had a certain kind of partnership between them that was supposed to continue Yaakov's sight and Yaakov's job. And any other thoughts? Where else do we see the relationship between Yosef and Binyamin? Obviously, they were the two brothers of sons of Rachel. There's a special relationship between them, though. What's the relationship we see? Okay. Okay, that was a strategic point in regards to Yaakov, but he did feel a special connection to him. And what happened when he came? He favored him. I'm going to skip ahead for a minute. Okay. Not only was Binyamin the only one who didn't go down to Esav and mess up over there, he also was the only one who didn't tell Yosef and mess up over there. So the brothers weren't really helping Mitaki in anything. They sold Yosef, and we had already the connection to eating and drinking, and Hamanach Ashrosh eating and drinking. There's a common flaw over there. And the brothers also, even before, they didn't respect Yosef. They shouldn't have sold him, but Yaakov favored him for a reason. Maybe they could have stopped and said, wait a minute, why is our father favoring him? Why is he coming to us with these dreams? Maybe there's something special about him. Maybe he deserves some respect. That's not the direction they went in, right? There was flaws in the brothers, but not in the Binyamin. So there's a tikkun that has to be made from Yaakov and Esav, there's a tikkun that has to be made from the brothers, and the ones that are in the perfect position to do this are Binyamin and Yosef and their descendants. Yosef also gave, he favored Binyamin, he gave him 5 sets of clothes when he came down, and Binyamin actually named his sons, is a gadata that he named his sons, all related, names that are related to Yosef's being lost. Yosef was never lost in Binyamin's mind, Binyamin was never lost from Yosef's mind. So I'm just going to skip ahead for a minute. Much later in the Gemara, it's very striking, in the little page that I sent you, it's still Zayin Amud Aleph, it's the very end of the daf though. The Gemara goes on a little tangent, and it starts talking about the Yosef story. And it says, "L'kulam natan l'ish chalafot shmalot u'binyamin," this giving clothing, right? Same element of clothing. Yosef gave clothing to everybody, but he gave chamesh chalifot, 5 sets of clothing, to Binyamin. And the Gemara says, this is strange. Efshar davarsa nitsa erbo otzot tzadik, now I'm continuing on, yikashelbo. Yosef was sold because of a problem with clothing, because of the ketonet pasim. He's going to take, and favoritism with clothing. He's going to take clothing and show favoritism to one of his brothers now? Isn't that so smart? What is he doing this for? What is it all about? So what does Gemara say? Amar Rav Bar Machatya. It doesn't even exactly answer. What's the answer here? Amar Rav Chama Bar Guria Amar Rav. Bishvil Mishkal Shnei Soleim Melat. On account of 2 sellers worth of woolen garments, which is the Ketanah Pasim, Shosif Yaakov Leosef Mishar Chav, that Yaakov gave Yosef extra, different from his brothers, Nidgalgal HaDavar Yardu Avotinu Mitzrayim. That's the Pas reference, the Karpas, right? Because of this Ketanah Pasim, they ended up going down to Mitzrayim. So what is Yosef doing here, doing the same thing to his brother? Amrad V'yamin Bar Yafet, what does he say? Shatid Ben Latzeit Mimenu, because one day, why did he send it to V'yamin? Because in the future there's going to be a Tikkun. Because one day, a son is going to be born to him, to Binyamin, a descendant. One day he's going to have a descendant who's going to come in front of the king with five Labushi Malchut. Etc. He counted five different articles of royal clothing that Mordechai is going to wear. Why do Yosef do this? Doesn't make any sense. It's because of this tikkun that goes on through the generations. It's because Yosef sensed something going on here. And he knew there were mistakes in his past, in his family's past, and he knew that Yosef was the key to the future, to it being fixed. And Yosef and Binyamin were partners in this tikkun. They took part in Yosef as the Ki'ilu Bechor, Binyamin as the one who was unpainted, both of them as the sons of Yaakov, who were going to ultimately help fix the problems of Yaakov. So all the similarities in the stories are because there's a intergenerational flaw and tikkun and gilgul and very deep stuff going on here. And ultimately, gilgul is a very interesting thing to explore. Ultimately, there's, who knows what's going on in the world? No clue what's going on in this world. And these are the connections of the story. It's both role model, but it's also a very deep, very complicated tikkun going on. Okay, this is why the Gemara is saying the Shvatim matter. Oh boy. The person who Haman's falling in front of is from these Shvatim, you're not getting anywhere, Haman. The tikkun is happening. It's happening, and you're the one who's suffering because of it. Okay, so getting back to, let's go back to our psukim here, okay? Because the next part of the Gemara is in the next part of the psukim. So, okay. I keep an eye on the time myself. Okay. I'm going to get too carried away. Okay. And so we are still in Paragvab. And we have Zeresh and his loved ones, his wise ones, giving him all this advice. Okay, he's going to fall. Pasuk Yadalad. Oda Midabrim, Imo, Visarisem Melchigiu. They're in the middle of this, not such nice advice. And already the king's servants are coming. Esther, and they're rushing in a big confusion to bring Haman to the party that Esther did. He just was totally humiliated, and now he's supposed to be in a position where he's totally honored in this party. And they're coming in a rush. And says Rashi, they came in such a rush that Haman didn't even have a chance to clean himself up. They whisked him away. And already here, there's a hashgacha process, because that's a little strange and not appropriate. Shouldn't the servants have enough common sense to say, it's okay, he'll come 5 minutes late, let him change his clothes and take a shower, and then he'll bring him to see the king. But no, they said, oh, the king is waiting, the queen is waiting, let's go, come on, no wait, no time for anything. It doesn't make any sense, right? But this is Hashem's hand, this is obviously, he was not meant to be in a positive light at this party in front of Achashverosh. And he was supposed to come in an already degraded state where Haman was, you know, look at him and Achashverosh, look at him and everything. We're going to see all these different ingredients that are making Achashverosh like him less and less. Okay? So this is the what happens when he was taken to the feast. The Gemara over here, let's see. What are we up to? That's the page. Okay, so we're on back to Amud Aleph. We're in the one that says 16a3. Vitaru Sehamal Kigyu Vayavhilu, right? That they were in the big confusion. Melamecha had the Uhu Bivehala, that they brought him to the palace in a confused state. And who does the halah refer to? Who's confused here? Who's in a rush and upset and confused? Not so clear, right? if we go with Rashi, that he was just taken, you know, as is, Haman would have been quite confused and upset. Like, what are you doing? You know, like, what's going on here? Stop. Right? Alternatively, it could be that the servants were upset and confused. Because here they are, they're supposed to bring the prime minister or this top man to meet with a private party with the king and queen, and they're like, this is the guy? Like, this is who we're supposed to take something? What is going on here? The whole situation didn't make sense, basically. Right? The situation makes sense. Haman is falling lower and lower, and the stage is set, being set more and more for the Yeshua. Okay? And Haman starts to get upset also. Rabbi Weinbach elaborates what might have been going through. Haman said, we saw already, he was just told by his loved ones, insensitively, that he's going to keep falling. Then he's taken in to go see the king in a very degraded state, which is further disturbing. And Rabbi Weinbach says that we had mentioned previously that earlier at the first party, Haman should have been suspicious because here, you know, he was invited to a private party of the king and queen, and he thought this is all about him. He left so happy, he left thinking he's the best on top of the world, when really, if he had been listening carefully, he would have noticed that the king at that party said, so Esther, what's your request? And Haman should have said, wait, why is he asking her about a request? Why am I here if he's asking her? Like, he should have started wondering and worrying, and he could have, and it was a day after the Gezerah, we had said, that the Gezerah was made, or maybe 2 days, if you follow the Maharal, the Gezerah was made in Yud Gimel Nisan, and the first day of the fast was Yud Dalet Nisan, and then the first party was Tevav, according to the Maharal, and the first day of Pesach, and he could have also noticed that, like, the queen is inviting, had some sort of request to the king, pretty soon after he just made this decree against the Jews, and she hangs out with Mordechai, and like, he should have noticed something going on, and he didn't, right? That was Hashgacha then, that he could have gone home that night and plotted what to do to save himself, but he didn't, he had no thought of it. Rabbi Weinbach says here, this Behala of Haman was the beginning of that realization. That all of a sudden, he was like, wait, I'm the bottom, Mordechai's on the top, there's another party with Esther, and there's a request in the Gezerah, and like, and suddenly he's getting upset. And he's saying, hold on, wait a second, what's this party? What's with Esther? What's with me? And also the hashgacha here is that now he doesn't have anywhere to go. He just finished consulting with his people, and now there's no chance anymore to consult with them. He's leaving. He's taken, and he's going to be at the party without any chance to plot something and strategize. And this is the hala, and this is the hashgacha of Haman not having any out, of not having anywhere to go. So this is how he's taken. Alshak points out that the terminology we had mentioned, because the first fast was the first party was when it was fasting, that it was the mishnah that Asta Esther, that she had made it, she wasn't really partaking in it. But here they're bringing him to the second one. Just one other point: it had said that after Haman took around Mordechai, Mordechai went back to his sackcloth and fasting, and that's because that day. So a little quick. I'm right over here. But that day, it's really important to know the follow what's going on. Again, I'm following my rabbi, and the rashi makes the comment also kind of with this timeline with the instructions. Okay? Yeah. Is it English? Okay, so here's Gimel, we have the decree is sent out. Yadalid, again, we're talking about Nisan here. We have the day one of the fast. Okay, we have Tevav, we have day two, and also, it seems, there could be, it's not so clear from the shot of the Megillah, but it seems that in the same day of day two was when Esther approached the king. Okay, and then apparently that's when there was the party. Things that have come up pretty soon afterwards. And then the night after the party is Nadadah Shnat HaMelech. So there's a lot going on. Okay, Tet Zion is day three of the fast. And already, even though they're all still fasting and mourning and crying and davening, already Mordechai is honored over here. Right, the day after he woke up and couldn't sleep, Mordechai is honored, and there's a strange mixture of things going on, where they're still davening in the morning, and yet they're arising up at the same time. But what happens? Mordechai goes back, and he still goes back to Shaar HaMelech, and he's still fasting, and he's still davening. Because throughout the Megillah, we've been playing with this relationship that Mordechai has with Shkacha Pratis, also Esther, where they're kind of like seeing all the Yad Hashem and what's going on, at the same time as tiptoeing around it, and not relying on it, and not making assumptions. And this is a common theme we've been developing, which is really interesting, because that's the whole idea of, you know, Hester Punim, is not just how we view the Megillah, it's how they were actually living in the story of the Megillah as it was happening. And so on one hand, he felt brave and bold enough to talk back to Haman we had seen in the Gemara. He's, you know, giving him a little kick when he steps on a horse, and he's, you know, demanding he cuts his hair, because he feels for Ben Adam Achavero, he felt that Haman should get the message already, that Mordechai's on top, and Haman deserves this, and he felt entitled to do that. On the other hand, he didn't want to rely on human action when it came to Hashem. Just because Achashverosh thinks highly of him, and he's behaving in a way that's more honor than Mordechai, then Haman doesn't necessarily mean that he knows what Hashem has in plan. He doesn't make any assumptions about Hashem. I can act this way to him, but Hashem, he still is davening, because it's still the third day to fast, and the deed is not done yet. There's still a gezeirah hanging over everybody, no matter how honored he is. He didn't get a letter to his head, he's still davening. And then we have the second party, and ultimately, then, that's really, of course, when, you know, it's very clear that things are in B'nai Shaul's favor and the tables are turned. Right, the question is, what's the third day from? Mm-hmm. It could be it was the third day counted from the decree. The question discuss what the third day is kind of from. Yeah, in other words, this isn't the only way to read it. It could be slightly different. But according to this, the fast day, this is just to take in this direction to understand that Ashkacha point, I'm going with this perspective. The day three is, it's a little ambiguous. What are we counting from there? It's a good point, though. Okay, so we have, let's go back to the shot, shall we? So we have Mordechai's back at the Shaar HaMelech, and Haman's taken to the party, and things are not looking good for Haman. Okay, Parag Zion. The Avo HaMelech v'Haman l'shtorim Esther HaMalkah. So they come to the party to drink with Esther. V'yomar HaMelech l'Esther gam v'yom ha'sheni v'mishteh ha'yayin. Mashi elaseich Esther HaMalkah v'tina tinlach. U'ma bakashateich ad kafi yamachu v'teach. V'tan Esther HaMalkah in Pasuk Gimel. V'atomor ima tatichin b'inecha HaMelech v'yom ha'Melech tov. Tina tein li nafshi v'sheilati v'ami v'bakashati. Pshat, what is the request? Nafshi is my sheila. And Ami is my bakasha. I'm asking for my own life. I'm asking for the nation to be saved. We're sold out to be destroyed. But if we had been sold out to be slaves, I wouldn't have done anything. Because the take on this that we'll say for now is the interpretation that the tsar, the enemy who sold us out, doesn't care for the king's property. They don't care if they damage the king's property. Implication being, if we had been slaves, I wouldn't have done anything because then you would have benefited from Am Yisrael. You could have used them and had their, you know, their service, but to get rid of them, you're not going to get their taxes, you're not going to get their service. It doesn't help you. Apparently, you should just know that this enemy who's trying to destroy us doesn't care for you and doesn't care for your well-being and for your property. Why is Esther saying this? This argument? Why doesn't she just say, save us? I'm your queen. They want to kill us.
She has to go with what Esther is able to hear. He's able to hear it apart from greed and his own status being improved.
Yes. So here she's being strategic. And also, she doesn't really know what's going on in Achashverosh's mind. Because Achashverosh was a sone of Am Yisrael. He was the one who stopped the Beit HaMikdash from being destroyed, from being rebuilt. He listened to Haman. He was, you know, he agreed to this gezeirah himself. So how is she going to convince him to counter the gezeirah that he himself approved? It's not just against Haman, it's against himself. What's she going to say to him? No, don't do that. Like, okay, but he already said he wants to do that. So what? So now she has to prove to him that it's not in his interest what he already decided. So this is why she has this kind of strategy, this argument here. And the Megillat Tarim says that that this is what she was afraid of, that she was afraid that it, she left on, that she's Jewish, and Ahasuerus still doesn't like the Jews, maybe his hatred for the Jews is greater than his love for Esther. And we know he's a fickle king, and he changed his mind. So, you know, he killed one queen. Why should it be enough to convince him that she has to be saved? She has to make it more, you know, what would speak to him. So this is, you know, simple looking at the psukim. Going to the Gemara, okay, we have, keep moving my stuff, sorry. Okay, 16:83. The Gemara says, "Kinim karnu ani ba'ami ki in hatar shadab ben ezekamel." So if it's in English, it's on the right column towards the bottom, second half of it. Amrolo, what did she say to him? Tsar de eino shadab ben ezek shel hamelech. This tsar, this enemy, Haman, doesn't care about damage done to the king. Ikane ba devashti v'katala. He was jealous, Haman was jealous of your previous wife, Vashti, and had her killed, because remember, he was the Russian advisor that recommended that Vashti be killed. Hashta ikane v'didi mivai l'miktulei. Now he's jealous of me, and he wants to kill me. And according to this Gemara, it's not only that she's trying to appeal to Ahasuerus' care for his money and physical possessions, but also to his emotions and his care for his wife. In other words,
he regretted what happened.
Exactly. Because he was
here
still sore.
Again, oh, well, Haman's doing something that you're not going to be happy with.
Yes, and we're going to, I'll jump to it now, why not? Which pasuk is it? In a little bit. Let's find the pasuk. He, you know, she reveals the story, he gets all mad, he leaves, jumping the head, keeps took him, and then, last pasuk, I find it. Last pasuk with Perek. But at the end, once Haman is gone, v'yitlu'et Haman al ha'eitz asher hechin l'morechai v'chamat ha'melech shachacha. And the anger of the king was abated. And we had noticed this lashon shachacha back at the beginning of the Megillah when we were involved in the Vashti story. And the Gemara, if you go ahead a little bit, now I'm going to give you a little spot in the Gemara. Hold on, I'm going to put my finger there so I don't lose it now. Okay. The Gemara said in the next page, also on the right side towards the bottom, Chamar Mel Shachacha, Shtei Shechichot Halalu Lama. It should have said Shacha, but it had an extra Chaf, says the Gemara. So what, there's two things that were abated over here. And the Gemara says, Achat Shel Makol Shel Olam, V'achat Shel Achashverosh. Maybe one time it's talking about Hashem's anger. Hashem was angry on Mishael to a certain extent. They had sinned. The Gezerah was not for nothing, whether it be in the time of Buchanesser or the time of the party. And Hashem's quote-unquote anger was abated, that now the Yeshua is coming. Hashem is gone with this picture of a Gezerah, and now comes the picture of Yeshua. And the second one whose anger was abated was Ahasuerosh. Or, on the next page of Gemara, the last section of Tzayin Amid Aleph, Vamrulay, the other opinion is Achashel Esther, V'Achashel Vashti. That what anger was abated? What's the double anger? His anger at Haman for having Vashti killed, and his anger at Haman for plotting against, for being against Esther. Once he gets rid of Haman, he feels better about both of them. All along, in the whole story, he had deep resentment against Haman that he recommended for Vashti to be killed. And this is also part of the Hashgacha Pratis, that he, you know, sometimes people feel better about things. It's like a few years, the whole story. Back when he spoke against Vashti was a few years ago. By this time, Ahasuerus likes Esther. He has a better wife. He's happy. He should forget about it. What is he so mad at Haman for? No, no. Hashem made sure that that would still boil inside of him. So he always had something against Haman. And now, when there's more and he needs to really have Haman done away with, he has what to build on. And this is the second chaf. This is what happens at the end of the parashah. Okay, so if we jump ahead a little bit, go back. We have a couple more minutes. Okay, so she said, you know, it's not in the king's interest, whether your money or your wife. You know, Haman doesn't care about this. He doesn't care about you. Therefore, you should save us, save me. Okay? Which is interesting because if we go with the Gemara, this is Esther speaking, that it's not Shava Beneza Kamelech, and the Gemara says, the enemy doesn't care about your feelings about, you know, how Haman killed Vashti. she didn't know what was going on in Achashverosh's head, presumably, maybe her Ruach HaKodesh, she did know. But in other words, she Dafka said just the right thing that would pull it, that underlying anger that was boiling inside Achashverosh all those years. That's what Shvachas do. She, you know, or maybe it was her strategy, I don't know, it's not so clear. Right? Something was perfect about that line, because it wasn't just some another argument, it was Dafka what was going to rile Achashverosh up to have his anger flare up again against someone.
I would say that she's trying to point out that he was manipulated by Haman.
Yes.
And here he finally acts like a king, and he's finally the one in charge, right? And he sends Haman off to be killed, because Haman's been walking around with his ring, doing whatever he wants, and manipulating him in various different ways, and now he's taking back his kingship.
Interesting.
So
yeah.
So Esther's definitely feeding into that.
Mm-hmm.
Look what he got you to do, and here he's doing it, you know. He's doing things behind your back.
Right. Interesting. Okay, good. Okay, so pasuk hey, vayomer hamalach Achashverosh, vayomer l'Esther amalka, mihu zeh ve'ezehu, zeh keli v'an zehu. But no, I kept looking for a page that said that. I didn't find one. Maybe there is one. But my interpretation is, who is the player of the chess game who's moving all the pieces? Is mihu zeh ve'ezehu? It's all Hashem, obviously. That's how I fill in the blank. But the pasuk fills in the blank. Achashverosh wants to know, who is this person? Hashem lo libo l'aso king. What do you mean, who's this person? It's you! It's Haman! You just had a gezeirah a few days ago to commit genocide against the whole nation. Well, my whole nation and me were destined to be killed out by someone. Who? I don't know. Who could it be? What do you think?
Well, if he has a feeling of guilt, then he certainly doesn't want to take it on himself.
Yeah.
So here's another opportunity to blame Haman.
Yeah.
Not me.
Okay, this is my favorite part of this year. Okay, ready? I'm gonna skip part of it. I'm gonna skip the next piece of Gemara because it's not my favorite part of this year, and we only have a few minutes left. So if you go to the 16a4, so what happened? Esther answers him, right? Pasuk Vava Tomer Esther Ish Tzar Ba'oyev Haman Hara Hazeh. Right? If there's a terrible enemy adversary, it's this evil Haman guy. Haman Nevat Nusnei Amelach V'Amalka. And the Gemara says, what did Esther do when she says, Ish Tzar Ba'oyev? Amar Avalazar, he says, M'lameh Shehaita Machavak Lapeh Achashverosh. She started pointing at Achashverosh. Who is the guy who's destroying your nation? You are! She couldn't help herself. She was pointing at him. What happens? V'Amalach V'Satari Azak Lapeh Haman. The Mal pushes her over. Says, don't point at Achashverosh, silly. Point at Haman. What are you doing? Right? And this Gemara, I don't know, I really like it. So the simple meaning is, first of all, Maral says that Haman was, Achashverosh was a little bit surprised, because Haman never finalized the law. If you remember, he sent it out in a rush, in a hurry, because he was, did a paper then that said that he first ran the idea past Achashverosh, but Achashverosh had to be convinced, he didn't really want to, and then Haman convinced him, and then the protocol was he was supposed to finalize it and get the final stamp, and he didn't. He skipped that part and he just sent it out. And so Achashverosh, because he was fickle, maybe he would have changed his mind on that one. And he was a little bit surprised. You know, what's the word? Who gave the, you know, can't think of a word? Who authorized this, you know? There was a little bit of a surprise here. But so the Ben Yehoyada gives a very logical explanation to understand this Gemara. He says that Esther, why was she pointing at Achashverosh? Because she was trying to say the same thing she said a minute ago, which was, this Haman is against you. He's an Ishtar Bo'yev against you. He has your worst interests in mind, right? This is, you know, who's doing this to me? He's not only doing it to me, he's doing it to you also. And then your other says, it wasn't so smart of her. You know, she strategized, she said the perfect line a minute ago, but now she didn't say the perfect thing and do the perfect thing. So, you know, she was thinking one way, oh, it'll show Achashverosh even more. Look, he's against you. But really, Achashverosh would interpret it, you're the Ishtar Bo'yev. So the Malach said, like, you know,
like the Midrash about Esther, right?
About the hand? Like, don't pick that one. Pick the other one. You know, what's the right answer? That's the right answer over there. You know, so he was saying, you know, she strategized. It wasn't such a great strategy. And the Malach said, don't do that. Okay? The simple understanding of the Gemara, the way I see it, I don't see it as an intellectual choice. I see it as an emotional choice. Because really, it doesn't make any sense. That's a stupid thing to do. Who did this to you? Who do you think she's talking about? Like, the guy did against you? No, you just asked me who did this to you, and I'm pointing to you. Like, that's not a rational thing to do. It's not smart. Maybe it was a stupid strategy, but like, maybe there wasn't a strategy. Maybe she lost it. I don't know, but this is how Gemara strikes me. Maybe she lost it. She put it all together. She strategized and she planned and she thought about how Achashverosh would think about things. And she did so much and she was so brave and she put her life on the line. She lost it. She couldn't anymore. We knew that she's not a purely intellectual being because she had a bodily reaction when she heard about the Gezeira against the Jews. We had the Gemara about that also already. And she was an emotional woman. And she has these crazy things at stake. And you're the star of all Yehiv. Come on! You made this Gezeira against me. Don't pretend like you're my friend. It's you. She couldn't handle it anymore. What happens when we plan and we strategize and we're smart and we're brave and we lose it? Then what do? Then Malach comes, pushes our finger over. Malach says, it's okay. She meant to pick that one. She's trying to point over there. And Hashem scoops us up. Hashem says, okay, you worked hard for this. I'll save you a little bit. And the Malach moves her finger over. That's why it's my favorite. We're not perfect human beings. Esther was not perfect. But when we put our lives in the line and we try and we think and we plan, Hashem helps us out. So, sure enough, I think we have to finish up a little over time. We'll continue next time, but Baruch Hashem, the wheels are turning, and Yeshua is coming, and things are going in the right direction.
Thank you.